of the day. Albany Banking Trust versus Exxon. Mr. Bernard?
May it please the court, my name is Frank Bernard. I represent the appellant, and I'm reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honor, this case is before the court in which we're asking the court to reverse Judge Lindberg in his dismissal of the underlying case, which was a Resource Conservation Recovery Act case. The judge dismissed the record count, holding that a portion of the record count was premature and that a portion of the record count was barred, and as a result of the filing of the, or the dismissal of the record count, the pendant state counts that had been filed were in fact dismissed. This was brought under a 12b-6, which means that all of the factual allegations of the underlying complaint have to be taken as true. As set forth in the brief, and as I'm sure you've reviewed in the complaint, what the plaintiff claimed was that the defendant, in this case ExxonMobil, owned and operated a gasoline service station, that there was a release of gasoline from that station, that the release contaminated adjacent property, that resulted in solid waste being deposited upon the adjacent property, that an investigation conducted by the plaintiff in this case indicated that the solid waste may have created a substantial and imminent endangerment, and as a result of that, notice was given to the defendant to clean up. No enforcement action was brought by either the state or the federal agencies, and the lawsuit was filed.
Judge Lindberg was concerned, and I want to focus here only on your complaint, not on all the documents that were floating around in conjunction with the disqualification motion. But I think he was concerned with paragraph 10 of the complaint, which does say that plaintiff requested that defendant ExxonMobil enter into an agreement before ExxonMobil could have access to your property, and that part of that agreement would be that ExxonMobil would promise to remediate, you know, things that were caused from the release. Now, it does seem that that much is on the face of the complaint, and if RCRA requires a certain duty of cooperation, then the question is whether you pleaded yourself out of court based on that.
Your Honor, the purpose of RCRA is to remediate, and the face of the statute itself says that a person can bring an action if, in fact, waste has been deposited that creates a substantial endangerment, which was what was pleaded. The request that was given to ExxonMobil was, after you investigate it, if you find there's contamination there as a result of your activities, which is pleaded in the complaint, you have to remove it. They wouldn't agree to do that.
Now, were you making, did the request, I'm not sure if this is in the record or not, because, again, may not be, but if the language as reflected in your complaint is something that's basically a synonym for we'll let you on the property, but we're reserving all rights to make you pay for what you've done, whether under RCRA, whether under state common law, whether under Illinois statutory law, or wherever the source may be. Is that what you were trying to do, or were you trying to get, as they argue, something much more than the law would have entitled you to?
Well, the question of what the law would entitle us to would be something that would be determined by the trial court based on the evidence that would have been presented.
Later.
In this case, we were never able to present any evidence, as Your Honor is aware, and since this would be a notice pleading in any event, the facts would be fleshed out as to what we would have been entitled to. The argument that was basically made by the defendant here was that under the U.S. EPA regulations with respect to RCRA, before they would remediate, they first had to investigate. Before they investigated, they had to have a right to access, although there's nothing in RCRA or in the regulations that deal with access.
But are you arguing that you can somehow have a RCRA action without ever letting Exxon or its agents investigate the contaminated property?
If, in fact, an investigation was conducted by the owner of the property that determined there was contamination that came from the adjacent property, there wouldn't be a need for an investigation by Exxon prior to the bringing of a RCRA action. because there would have been the establishment of contamination, a waste deposit, and a substantial endangerment. It's important to also note here, Your Honor, that in this particular case, there was no enforcement action or there was nothing involving the U.S. EPA.
Right.
I mean, this
right.
was the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency, and to take the rules dealing with the U.S. EPA and to try and apply them to the Illinois EPA when there are different jurisdiction or a different sovereign and different rules is sort of an apples and oranges type of situation.
And where do you find support for that argument that you've made or the statement that you've made that if the owner determines that there's contamination, then the neighbor, in this case Exxon, wouldn't have any right to conduct its own investigation?
I'm certainly they'd have a right to do it on discovery in connection with litigation. The issue is whether or not if the property owner determines there's contamination on their property, before they can bring a RCRA action, they have to allow the other party to investigate the property. That's not part of RCRA. There's no requirement in RCRA in the statute that says that a responsible party has to be granted the right to make their own investigation prior to a bringing of a RCRA action. As a matter of fact, the statutory requirements are quite specific, and in this case, the complaint pleaded they were followed, and that has to be accepted as true, that all of the RCRA requirements were met, and that then resulted in the complaint being filed. So that if you look at the face of the complaint, irrespective of the arguments that were presented in connection with the motion to disqualify that the court ruled was inappropriate, the facts are that the defendant, in fact, had an obligation to clean up under RCRA, and how much they had to clean up would be decided by the trial court.
So you would say once you follow the RCRA statutory obligations, including notice and all the rest of that, you can file the lawsuit, and to the extent the degree of contamination is contested, there are vehicles like Rule 34 for orders permitting entry on land for your opponent to perhaps make their own assessment or other
And
mechanism.
That, in fact, happened in this case, Your Honor. After this case was filed, the court ordered the defendant to have access to the property. The defendant had access to the property. The defendant drilled the holes, took the samples, sent it to the lab, and then the court dismissed the case, saying the defendant hadn't had access to the property, although it was done pursuant to court order.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, there's nothing in RCRA that says that before, there's no additional element in RCRA that says, and before you file a complaint, you have to let the other party investigate.
Now, could I just for a moment turn to your claim that you have a right to be reimbursed for your own investigation? Because I have to tell you, after both the Supreme Court's decision in the Megrig case and this court's decision in Avondale, I don't see how you can sustain such a claim. Looks like if you have voluntarily undertaken your own investigation, you just did that, and you're going to bear the costs, just like any party who does a Rule 11 investigation prior to filing bears the cost of what they've done to investigate whether they've got a legitimate claim.
I don't think that issue has ever been addressed by any court as to whether or not a pre-suit investigation, which would be required by Rule 11 in order to determine whether you have a waste with a substantial endangerment, is a cleanup.
But certainly, I mean, if Rule 11 is your analogy, you're on flimsy ground, because normally you bear your own Rule 11 costs, and Avondale certainly addresses this in quite broad language. As you may recall, I dissented in Avondale, but nonetheless, it's the law of the circuit, and that's where we are now.
But Avondale also involved a cleanup, so that the investigation led to the actual removal of the contamination, which isn't what occurred here. Here, there was an investigation to determine whether there was a violation of RCRA. And I point the court to this court's opinion in a case totally in a positive factually, but in the case of Wisconsin Power and Light versus Century Indemnity, which I believe is cited in our brief, where the court indicated that investigative costs that are incurred to demand compliance with the law are not necessarily damages, but they're recoverable costs. And that was in an insurance context, and admittedly not a RCRA. But there the court in an environmental context was saying there's a difference in kind between an investigation in order to try and force someone to comply with the law and an investigation conducted in connection with other activities.
That may be true, but the line the Supreme Court was looking at in Megrig and that this court followed in Avondale had more to do with the difference between equitable relief and damages, money payments. And whatever the purpose of your investigation may have been, it cost you money, of course, these things do. And if this equitable versus injunctive relief line is the one that governs, once again, how can you get money for this? If you decide to do it and to undertake that cost, so much the better for you, but you've just got to do it on your own.
Because as your Honor is aware, in both Megrig and Avondale and the progeny from there, they're dealing with situations where the person completed the remediation and then sought recovery for the remediation, and what the court said is there's no longer a substantial endangerment. Once you've cleaned it up, there's no substantial endangerment that then imposes a RCRA obligation. Here, it's not cleaned up. 3 years later, it's still there. And so the point is that in Megrig and Avondale and the other cases, what had happened was the cleanup had been accomplished and the court was being asked to require the other person to reimburse them. And I see that if I don't stop, I'm going to lose my rebuttal time. So I will be looking forward to your further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bernard. Mr. Berkland?
I'd like to start by pointing out to you, Your Honor, that there's nothing in this case and the district court's ruling in this case that's in any way inconsistent with your dissent in the Avondale case. You go into a great analysis of the difference between post-litigation or post-filing of a lawsuit, expenses that are incurred, and the importance of that in the pre-filing period. In this case, it's a pre-filing expense that's being sought for reimbursement. So there isn't any inconsistency there. I'd like to touch just on a couple of points. The first and most important one, again, goes back to a question that was raised before. We certainly agree with the plaintiff that there's no imposition of an obligation by RCRA on the plaintiff to allow access to the property. There isn't. The plaintiff can choose whether or not to allow access and can choose whatever conditions it determines is appropriate to get access. But then the plaintiff can't sue.
Why is
That's
that? I don't see that in RCRA at all. It seems to me that there are requirements in RCRA on the face of it, and for all I know, you know, at later stages of the proceeding, there might be, you know, capabilities of investigating this on summary judgment, but the idea that you're right under RCRA to seek to have somebody who made your property polluted remediated is contingent on pre-litigation easements, if you will, pre-litigation access to the property, I don't see in the statute. And it seems to me what the district court has done here is perhaps imposed a legal requirement on these filings that the statute at least doesn't mention.
I think there are two reasons in response to that, Your Honor, as to how that works. First of all, the invocation of the district court's jurisdiction in this matter is only upon an allegation or of noncompliance.
Right.
And there is no allegation of noncompliance in this case other than that ExxonMobil did not properly undertake to remediate potential contamination on the neighboring property. That's the only basis upon which the jurisdiction, what's that?
I mean, what they allege is that you contaminated their property, right? I mean, that's
correct.
The initial allegation.
Right, that's part of their base.
And now they want you to remediate it, but as you know from these various decisions, some of the obligation to remediate does arise under RCRA, maybe not everything, but there's preservation of common law remedies, there are state remedies. So it seems to me kind of precipitous to say just because, to find in RCRA a precondition to suit that the contaminating party be allowed access to the land strikes me as reading an extra provision into the statute. The statute has all kinds of provisions, as you know. I mean, it's got waiting periods, it's got all kinds of stuff, but not this. And so why isn't it exactly the case, as Judge Williams' question brought out, that, of course, eventually the contaminating party will have access under Rule 34 or under whatever other provisions, but where's the pre-filing condition?
It isn't a pre-filing condition, Your Honor. I think it's more properly contemplated as the basis for a citizen's action under RCRA is that there is a non-compliance that needs to be redressed. RCRA is constructed as an opportunity for a private citizen to enforce, as a private attorney general, the provisions of the statute. Just like the government would not be able to file a lawsuit against ExxonMobil if it impeded or obstructed its ability to comply, so a private party can't do that. You've drawn a very important distinction between private remedy and the remedies that are allowed under RCRA. If there is a common law claim of trespass or nuisance, or if there are other statutory claims, whether under the Illinois Environmental Protection Act or another federal statute, that can be invoked by the plaintiff under those circumstances, so be it. It's just that the RCRA provision for allowing a private action is upon a showing of noncompliance.
But do you have a case that actually reads the concept of noncompliance as broadly as you are urging us to read it, that says noncompliance doesn't even arise until the contaminating party has been asked to and refused to clean up?
Well, I don't think you need to reach that point. I think we do have a case that's square on this from the Northern District, and that's Judge Moran's decision in the Aurora National Bank case.
But that's, well, first of all, obviously not binding on us, but it's,
I have not found a circuit court level opinion that states that, Your Honor, but I don't think you need to get to that point. What we're talking about here is, even if there's a lot of time spent on the notion that the plaintiff has pleaded prima facie elements of his claim. However, the plaintiff has then pleaded one additional fact, or two, and that is that prior to allowing ExxonMobil to follow the statutory and regulatory prescribed course of compliance, the defendant, ExxonMobil, was required to agree to these conditions prior to access, which included removal of contamination and reimbursement of expenses.
But why wasn't that, as I asked him, just a synonym for saying we're reserving all of our rights under the statute?
Right.
They could have said that.
They could have said that, but they didn't plead that. What they pleaded is that they have imposed these conditions on ExxonMobil's ability to comply.
Why aren't the things that we read here in paragraph 10 simply the equivalent of a reservation of rights?
Because immediately after that, Your Honor, in the next paragraph of the complaint, the plaintiff concedes that ExxonMobil refused to agree to those conditions but continued to seek access to investigate, which is RCRA compliant.
But you see, I don't see where RCRA allows trespasses. I mean,
doesn't, and they don't have to allow it. They don't have to let the ExxonMobil on their property under any circumstances if they don't want to, but then they can't invoke the right to sue as an attorney general, private attorney general, to enforce the noncompliance that they impeded the correction of. They
don't have. I understand your logic. It's just that I can't find it in the statute. I can't find something that says the RCRA right of action is contingent upon this particular regime that you're arguing for.
Well, I guess maybe it's more simple than that. It's hard to conceive of a circumstance where the government could sue in a civil action a private company complaining of regulatory noncompliance when in fact it's the government that has obstructed that compliance. And that's all that RCRA allows the private citizen to do.
Is it your position, Mr. Berkland, that remediation has within it, as an initial step, the opportunity to go on and examine the property?
It's a necessary component in this case where adjacent property is involved. The RCRA regulations specifically provide for investigation of the property, a determination of the scope. And the plaintiff admits that on page 17 of the plaintiff's brief. It says that the defendant's scope and duty to remediate cannot be determined at this time. And that's in fact the case. So compliance can't be achieved. As a matter of regulatory law, compliance can't be achieved without that action. The duty, of course, is borne by ExxonMobil to achieve that. And so what we have here is the imposition of a condition that's extra-regulatory, conceded to me, and the reimbursement of expenses, another extra-regulatory condition, that is a condition preceding to regulatory compliance, and then a lawsuit under the Attorney General private provisions of RCRA saying you didn't do what you were supposed to do. It put the company in an impossible situation.
Of course, the district judge tosses the whole complaint, even though they were interested in many theories of recovery that didn't have anything to do with RCRA.
Well, that's right. The other RCRA count was dismissed without prejudice, which was the failure to remediate. This is the same complaint that in count 5 seeks $2 billion of damages. I can't resist saying that to you. But it's, of course, perfectly appropriate once the federal claims are dismissed for the court not to retain supplemental jurisdiction over the purely state law claims, which were the claims that were stated in counts 3, 4, and 5 of the complaint.
And you would agree similarly that if we thought this did need to be reinstated, the state law claims come back in for the time being.
I certainly have no basis upon which to disagree with that,
yeah.
Your Honor. Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Berkman. Mr. Bernard.
Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel. I'll be short, Your Honor. For some reason, we're talking about noncompliance here, but there's been no, I would point out, under the scheme of RCRA, once the notice is given, under this court's prior holdings, unless there's an enforcement action brought by the government agency, there isn't a stay on a private cause of action, and that's the PMC case. Here, defendant has never asserted that once we gave notice, there was an enforcement action brought. They're saying, in fact, that while we were attempting to do stuff, you wouldn't let us do stuff, and therefore we can't bring RCRA. The only prohibition against bringing a private cause of action under RCRA is after the notices have been given, an enforcement action has been brought, which equates to a judicial proceeding.
But couldn't you have saved a lot of time if you had just let them on the property? I mean, were you really afraid you were going to waive your rights under these rather strong statutes?
Your Honor, it depends. What we're talking about is upon whose terms. We have not gone into the factual discussion as to what they were demanding for access and what we were requesting, because that's not pertinent to the complaint. But if a party says, I want access to your property on the following terms, and you don't agree with those terms, then does that mean that they get to dictate what the terms are of the access before you can bring a RCRA complaint, which is what we're arguing in our brief. That if the party comes in and says, we want to have access to your property and we can investigate forever, and as long as we're doing that, you can't bring an action against us, do we have to agree to that?
How can I start remediation without some examination?
Once there's been a determination that there is, in fact, a substantial endangerment, a deposit of waste, the court has the authority to order them to remediate it. We have made that determination. That factual determination is pleaded in the complaint, and the court ignored that and basically said that unless the determination of substantial endangerment comes from the defendant, the plaintiff doesn't have a right to bring an action under RCRA. And that certainly is not what RCRA provides. So, Your Honor, I would also like to point out that the Aurora National Bank case that they cited is also not on point, because as we point out in our brief, the issue in Aurora National Bank was a demand by the property owner that they be paid back rent and going forward rent as a result of contamination being left on the property. The trial court found that that was an attempt to get a financial gain. Here what we had requested is those costs we had incurred in connection with determining that there was contamination on our property be reimbursed. There's a significant difference in kind. That is not a financial reward. That is being made whole.
I just want to get back to Judge Flom's question, because in response you said, in terms of letting them examine the property, who knows, they could have wanted this inspection to go on for years. Things could have gone on forever. But I don't understand why you didn't make an effort to come up with a reasonable agreement. I mean, it seems to me the parties could determine, you know, we'll give you 3 months or 6 months. It seems like a great waste of resources to approach it in this way. I'm just talking from a practical standpoint now.
Your Honor, I'm sure you don't want me to get into what the discussions were with respect to 3 months or 6 months, because that's not of the record. But let me say that there were negotiations that were conducted, that a one-sided position on those negotiations was presented by the defendant in its motion to disqualify, which were the settlement discussions that took place before the lawsuit was filed. The question as to whether or not something is reasonable, I guess, depends on the eye of the beholder.
Let me ask you this question. If your position is the appropriate one, Mr. Bernard, And we had a factual situation similar to what we're confronted here. And your position being that you can go forward with a suit after your own examination. If your examination were to be found wanting, that is, that you were in error, what would be the appropriate relief in a case like that? But if in this case they believe they may have contaminated, so let's continue that hypothetical, and you go forward and claim your examination produced certain results, those results prove not to be the case. Is this just a cost thing, or could it be sanctions for a situation where you determine there is a violation, it turns out not to be, what would be the appropriate trial court disposition in a case like that?
I guess, Your Honor, it's no different than any other lawsuit.
Would it be subject to, let's say, Rule 11 sanctions, you mean?
I'm assuming that the trial court, whatever authority the trial court would have, the trial court would have that authority as in any other lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
Any case that's pleaded where there's a factual issue, if the court finds the facts against one side or the other, the court has the right to make a determination one way or the other whether or not they feel the allegations were made in good faith. And that, Your Honor, as we indicated in our brief, was the reason why there was a pre-suit investigation. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, sir. Thank you to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.